Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die screaming.
Hello there, welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, and I'm here with Andy Steiger, the director of Apologetics Canada, as usual.
Good to be with you.
So, we just finished our fifth annual conference. Andy, how did you think it went?
Well, first, it's incredible to think that we've had five conferences now. Mm-hmm. Like, we've been going for 5 years. And I thought the conference went awesome. In fact, I heard from people that just felt like this was one of our best years yet. Mm-hmm. And we had an incredible lineup of speakers. And then, you know, it's funny, every year after we finish a conference, I think to myself, like, how on earth are we going to do better next year?
Right.
But amazingly, we find another great group of speakers. But I felt like this year was one of our best lineups ever. I mean, we had Nancy Piercy, Sean mm-hmm. McDowell. We had a number of TED Talks. The first time we've ever done that. We call them Rethink Talks, mm-hmm. where they're short 20-minute addresses that address a certain theme. And then, we had a Luis Marcos, mm-hmm. who ended up being just an incredible speaker and engaging personality. And on the whole, I was really amazed on the whole thing.
How did you come to hear about Dr. Marcos?
It's funny. Every year when we find a speaker, you know, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. We sometimes find their book first, and then we look them up and see if they're a good speaker, because sometimes people are good writers, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're good speakers. But in this case, one of my addictions is a little thing called the Teaching Company or the Great Courses. Those people who know me know that I have a hefty surplus of their courses.
That's right.
I'm a bit of a perpetual student. So if you've never seen this company before, it's incredible. They have courses on everything you can imagine. By some of the best professors and award-winning professors
right.
from whatever university you can think of. And so I like it because it gives you a variety of perspectives. It's not always a Christian perspective, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. And as well, these people are passionate about these subjects. They're well-researched. And I find them engaging. I mean, it's rare that I come across a course that I don't find engaging. I think now I've gone through 60 mm-hmm. courses over these last years.
If they had a VIP program, you'd be at the top of the list.
I would. And so I was listening to one of their courses on C.S. Lewis, and Luis Marcos was doing that. And honestly, of all the great courses I've ever gone through, I would say his is top five mm-hmm. easy.
Yeah, he didn't even use any notes when he was here. I was just listening through his lecture editing the videos last yeah. week, and it was just fantastic.
Yeah, so I was thinking top five best great courses ever. But yeah, you're right, even just speaker-wise for the conference, one of the best speakers we've had here. The thing I like about him is just he's passionate. And like you said, I mean, yeah. the guy didn't even use mm-hmm. notes. He's an incredible individual.
Okay, well, I'll put in a shameless plug here. Our conference DVD is going to be ready in just a few weeks' time here. I know a lot of you have been really anxious to get your conference DVD, but as these things work out, they take a little bit of time to be ready, and they'll be ready to be shipped in a couple weeks' time. So just hang in there, and be sure to check out our website, apologeticscanada.com/store, and you can order or pre-order right now the conference DVD there. So that's the conference this year, but we have more than just that one conference.
Yeah, this year is incredible. Not only do we have the conference that happened here, but this weekend we have a conference happening in Barrie, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And then in June we have a conference taking place in Toronto, in Ontario. So it's mm-hmm. it's a busy year. And in fact, it's kind of neat how it works. Basically, it's individuals in churches or a church and different organizations that are working together under the umbrella of Apologetics Canada to host these conferences. So it might sound like, wow, Apologetics Canada is doing a lot of work. Well, not really.
No.
Yeah, it's actually, there's churches out there with other individuals that are doing a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of laid down the foundations for them to work off of, whether that be our ticketing or using our web or media or just the things that we've learned on how to run a conference. Mm-hmm. And we basically equip them to do that. And so we're excited about it as well. Not only will I be speaking out there this weekend, we're looking forward to that, but also we'll be on 100 Huntley Street doing an interview.
That's right.
For the new book that just came out last month, Thinking, Answering Life's Five Biggest Questions. And in that show, I believe will air at the end of June.
Okay.
So be looking for that.
Awesome. Well, we'll keep you posted on that, so make sure you catch that that show when Andy's on.
And go online to find out more about these other conferences, if that's of interest to you, if you know people in that area that you could promote it to.
Right. Again, go to our website, apologeticscanada.com, and you can click the conference link there, and you'll be able to see both the Barrie location and the Toronto location and get more information on who's speaking there, what topics will be addressed, so on and so forth.
And if you're there, come on out. We'd love to see you.
Absolutely, yeah. We have a new guy joining us in May.
We do. We have a new staff member. His name's Chris Battle. That will be joining us in May. Actually, he's pretty much packing up his place now in Quebec. They might already be on the road, actually, or setting off pretty quick here, because they're going to be in Barrie.
Right.
Well, I'm meeting them there for the conference this weekend, and then they continue on across Canada.
Right.
Here, yeah.
They're driving across
Canada.
Yikes.
Exactly. So, yeah, Chris Battle and his wife, Sarah. We're looking forward to having Chris on staff.
Yeah, you've known him for a few years now, haven't you?
Yeah, something like 7-8 years. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Chris's story is in my book, Thinking. You can see it in chapter 6. I think it's actually a fascinating way that we end, that I end the book.
That's right.
Is on a discipleship note. And I talk about discipleship from both perspectives, from my perspective, and then Chris in his own voice talks about discipleship from his perspective. And you can also hear more about his story on the conference DVD. But Chris spent a number of years in drug and alcohol addiction and came out of that and has been clean for a long time now. I don't remember how long it is now. But he's just graduating with his BA in Biblical Studies, and he's starting a master's degree. And God's just doing incredible things in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting if you... Again, if you want to know more about that, I'd read that, chapter 6. It tells the whole story.
Okay, well, it's been a long time, and we're finally coming back around to the zombie culture talk here. And so we're moving on to session 2, and we're talking about the creation of people. So I'll just read Genesis 1, verse 26 to 31. So if you have your Bibles with you, you can look that up now. Genesis 1, 26 to 31. It says this: Then God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So this passage obviously is very important in the Judeo-Christian worldview, in that human beings are seen to have been created in a very special way, and we use the term Imago Dei, the image of God. Mm-hmm. Why is this so significant?
Let me restate to demonstrate why this is so significant. Let me remind our listeners how we're defining the word zombie culture, or the idea zombie culture. Mm-hmm. Basically, zombie culture is referring to any worldview that leads to the dehumanization of people. Mm-hmm. And so the whole premise of the zombie talks or zombie culture, mm-hmm. is we're playing off the idea of zombies. Now, I know a lot of people will think of zombies demonically, but we're not referring to them in that way. Mm-hmm. To be honest, most of our culture that talks about zombies, I don't know any of them that refer or think of them demonically. Mm-hmm. They think of them as an object with a lack of personhood. Mm-hmm. And so basically, in many ways, it's a thought experiment of sorts of what a human would be like if it lacked personhood. And this ultimately becomes a zombie, which, fascinatingly enough, is a terrifying idea for us. We're quite disturbed by something that lacks, by a person who lacks personhood. Mm-hmm. And so when we've been looking at this, we've been basically saying there's four main things that are created in Genesis 1 to 3. God creates three of them. Man creates the fourth. And so on our last podcast, we talked about how God created the universe. Today we're talking about how God created life. Next time we'll talk about how God created relationships, and then lastly we'll deal with how people created evil. Mm-hmm. What's important to note is that God is significant in all four of these. And in fact, God is necessary in all four of these in order in order to sustain our humanity. And that without God, we in fact lose our humanity. We lose ourselves. And so that's why this passage is so significant. It's significant to note that God created life. That's important. But then more than that, on top of that, that not only that God created life, but that God created us in His image, mm-hmm. which raises a number of questions. For example, how did God create human life?
Well, from Scripture, it's interesting because when God creates everything else, He just does it by the word of His mouth. You know, let there be, and there's light, there's sun and the moon, and there's all the animals. But when it comes to the creation of human beings, it specifically says that God breathed into this pile of mud, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there is something that God imparts of Himself to this creation. And so in that sense, it's kind of different. I think the author of Genesis was kind of going the distance to set human beings apart from the rest of creation.
Absolutely. And that's an important even phrase there, the author of Genesis. We constantly need to remind ourselves, mm-hmm. that when we're reading the Bible, that there is an author. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, it is God breathed. Now, this is interesting, and we could get into this later. Mm-hmm. But it is relationally written. It is both human and divine. That God did not dictate this. God didn't scratch it into a wall on His own. God used people, mm-hmm. used human authors to write together His words. And so what we're looking at then is what was the intended meaning of the author, mm-hmm. to at that time? And that I think the thing that we mentioned last time, and we got to mention again, that's just important to remember, is the author wants to make it clear two things, I think, or more. And that is that God created not only the universe, but in today we're looking at that God created life. God created not just life, but that God created human life, and He imparted on it something that was unique and distinct from all other creation. That the rest of the animal kingdom doesn't have what humans have. Mm-hmm. Now people have talked a lot about what could that be. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? And I realize that is a debated question, but I think that there's some things that we definitely know that it means. Now, when we think about God's image, we can ask ourselves, well, what kind of image is God? And the Bible makes it clear that God is inherently relational, mm-hmm. that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, this is significant. It means that God lives in relationship mm-hmm. within his very essence. Now, a lot of people don't think about this, but when we say that God is love, I mean, that's a significant statement. And in many ways, is kind of bizarre. I mean, how could somebody embody love mm-hmm. when you particularly understand that love is a relational term? Mm-hmm. So it would almost seem as though, you know, God would almost need to create people in order to have an object to love, unless you have the Trinity, unless you have a triune God, a relational God. Well, then God embodies love within his very essence, and so it actually makes sense to say that God is love. Mm-hmm. He is the standard of right relationship within himself.
Yeah, that's the really cool part. Like he doesn't need anything or anyone else, rather, to have that relationship, which is
to complete himself. Yeah,
which is a bit of an issue for any sort of Unitarian theologies, like. In Islam, for example, God is said to be one, like Tawheed, right? He is absolutely one. There are no divisions of persons or anything like that. And the same would go for, say, Jehovah's Witness. They don't think that Jesus was... they think he was a created being and the Holy Spirit is sort of a divine force, impersonal force, so to speak, which means that before creation... God had no one else to love. It wasn't directed at anything else. But it's only when he creates, people that he can have this relationship. So in that sense, he is dependent on what he creates, which is not at all the kind of if you go by the sort of the maximal being theology, that doesn't really jive very well, I don't think.
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the beauties of Christianity. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people want to avoid the Trinity as this unfortunate theology that we have that just doesn't make any sense or something like that. But in fact, it does make sense, and it's absolutely necessary, and it's something that we should cherish mm-hmm. and not be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, Steve, that this would lead to a number of problems, without it. Now, this gets into some interesting ideas, though, that I kind of want to tease out. And one of them is that if God is inherently relational and that God has created me and he's made me in his image, it would make sense then that God has made me to be relational as well. Mm-hmm. Now, this gets interesting, though, because then we could say, well, what's different between God and me relationally? And God is different in the sense that God has one essence or one soul, but three persons. This would be the Christian understanding of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Three persons, one essence. Now, I, however, am one soul and one person. And so I am relationally made in God's image, but I am not God, and I am distinct from God. I am a separate creation. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, I think, inherently one of man's flaws or problems, okay. is that we don't see ourselves correctly. And so, because we've been made in God's image and we are so relationally geared, like everything about us is relational. In fact, we don't know how to relate to anything unless we relate to it relationally. So, for example, when we tell a story, we always have to use anthropomorphic language.
Right.
Now, anthropomorphic language is basically language in which you give human characteristics, in which you give personhood to objects or to animals, mm-hmm. and you animate them in such a way that you can even have a story.
Right.
Without doing that, without anthropomorphic language, you don't even have a story to begin with.
Right.
So I think about, my kids and I were watching Charlotte's Web the other day.
Right.
right? And if, so if you've ever seen Charlotte's Web, you got this pig, you got a spider, horse, mm-hmm. ducks, you know, and they're talking and they're behaving like people.
Right.
Well, it's only through that that we can relate to that animal, or that we can even tell a story. Or I think about a lot of our young adults here at Northview, where I'm also the young adults pastor. They name their cars, right? And I did as well. I had a car back in the day that I named the Beast. Steve, have you ever named a car?
No, actually, I personally haven't, but I've seen my friends do it all the time.
Now, we will, though. I refer to our vehicles, though, with a pronoun.
Right, she
or him. Normally, yeah. It's a girl,
yeah.
Right? You know, like oftentimes I tell people that my car, she's got a drinking problem, I said, right?
That's right.
She enjoys gasoline. So we just inherently do that. We mm-hmm. we talk about things as persons. Now the problem is, though, is we can be tempted to think that we are doing this with God. That mm-hmm. that I become God, and people begin to think I am creating some sort of idea, and I'm thinking about this cosmic God with anthropomorphic language. And the Bible's right. saying no, that's not the case.
It's precisely the other way around.
That's right. It's the other way around, which we would call theomorphic language. Mm-hmm. That I have been made in God's image, mm-hmm. and I inherently want to reflect that image. And it's God who made me into a person, mm-hmm. and I am wanting to make other things into persons. And it's that, and it's in that way that I can relate with them.
Just as a side note, if you've noticed, when we're talking about the image of God, we're not talking in terms of the physical image at all, like God having hands or eyes or having some kind of a vocal apparatus so he could speak or anything of that sort. Because I think that it is a common misunderstanding, especially among our skeptic friends, who think that when we're talking about the image of God, we're talking about that physical resemblance. That's not at all what we're talking about. Anyway, we'll just file
that. That's great. Now, this leads into some interesting cultural commentary. Mm-hmm. Because if you've been watching any movies right now, I mean, honestly, it seems to me like it's like 9 out of 10 movies right now are dealing... Maybe that's a little extreme. Okay, 7 out of 10 movies will deal with these themes that we're talking about right now. But they're dealing with them in unique ways that lead into this topic of zombie culture, in which people begin to get tempted to remove God out of this equation. So they move away from theomorphic language and only to anthropomorphic language. That I'm no longer made in God's image, I just make things in my image. And then we begin to ask, well, if that's the case, if God's not there at all, and it's just a human and I'm making things in my image, the question of our culture today is, well what kind of image is that? Mm-hmm. What exactly is a person? And so we've begun, particularly in our movies, I see this so much. I mean, right now as we're filming, recording this, Chappie is in theaters.
Okay.
And this is a movie about artificial intelligence. Mm. Now, that might surprise people. Oh, I thought we were talking about zombies. No. Listen, we're talking about anything that dehumanizes people. We're talking about what does it mean to be a person? Mm-hmm. So for, you know, the sake of interest, I'm using zombies, but it could be anything. It could be your cell phone. It could be your computer.
Right.
It could be now this is where things get interesting. It could be an algorithm. Mm-hmm. So what happens now is, particularly in our movies, we are beginning to use anthropomorphic language about computer code. Now that is very new, right? Mm-hmm. I remember I was watching a movie not too long ago. It was Captain America, mm-hmm. and being from the United States, as you can imagine, I enjoy watching that movie. And I'm watching Captain America, what is it, Winter Soldier. And in it, who's the bad guy? The evil villain ends up being this guy who basically codes himself into a computer. And it raises some serious questions. I find it fascinating how quickly that'll come by us in a movie, and we won't blink an eye to that. This idea that this villain could program himself, his, mm-hmm.
His person could be coded, could be made into an algorithm and placed into a computer. Right. And so now he's lived on in the computer and he is continuing to do his evil deeds.
Yeah, that does seem to be a pretty common theme, like in movies. And I'm a bit of a gamer myself, and when I play video games, it that theme comes out. Like, for example, if you can sort of code yourself, like you said, and then just transfer that into a new body, you are there. And so all you are then basically is just basically like computer software.
That's right. In fact, I was reading in Wired magazine recently. They were actually talking about this because and it was interesting. The author of this article was actually kind of concerned about it because we begin to pit ourselves against computers and begin to think about ourselves as computers. The irony is we made the computer, right? So Wired magazine was kind of demonstrating this. They were talking about how on May 11th in 1997, Deep Blue defeated the first world champion chess player for the first time. And that was a major achievement. And it's one of those moments where we go, look, you know, look at what computers can do. Mm-hmm. And one of the main pieces of Wired magazine, though, one of the things they're saying is, yeah, look what the computer did, but look who created the computer to do that.
Right.
And then again in 2011, Watson competed and won Jeopardy against some of the best former winners. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, wow, look at what computers can do. And he's like, yeah, but who created that computer? And now, again, we're making there's a big distinction between a computer beating somebody at a game and a computer being a person. And Wired magazine was making this point because right now, the big thing is there's a game that I've never played. Have you played it? It's called Go.
Yes.
Apparently, Asians love this game.
Oh yeah, it's a very popular, and it's sort of it's a highly respected game. It's very it involves complex strategies. It's about winning territories, basically. That's the simplest way that you can put it. You have one player has all the black stones, the other player has all the white stones. And you take turns placing one stone at a time. And the goal of the game is to claim as many territories, like those grids that you see, those intersections, those points.
Don't you win by surrounding your opponent?
Right, surrounding it. So you can surround your opponent, and then your opponent can surround you on top of you, and so on and so forth. So who comes out on top? Well, whoever possesses as many of those intersections as possible. So it's a territory winning kind of a game.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Wired magazine was saying it's possibly one of the most complicated games that we have. And even though it's like 2,000 years old,
that's right.
It's incredibly complicated. And so right now there's a computer software called Crazy Stone, and they've been working on this to see if they could defeat a world champion Go player. Mm. Now to date, they haven't been able to do that. Some wonder if it's even possible to, because the game is so complicated. Mm-hmm. They're not sure if they could create a computer that could beat a person at it. But that really wasn't the point of this whole article. Wired magazine was saying, listen, maybe they could create a computer that beat people at it. But they were saying this, that they were saying ultimately, Watson, Crazy Stone, they were saying, are not beings. These are not people. What they are solutions to specific problems. And I think that this is important for people to appreciate, because in our current culture of defining something or to understand what something is, we really have difficulty understanding what we are and how we differ from a computer. And more than that, how do we differ from a computer program like Crazy Stone? You know, what's the difference between the two? And clearly, there are big differences, but they're hard for us to nuance. Because, like I was saying, in our culture, what we do when we want to understand something is we do what's called reductionism. Mm-hmm. You want to explain that, Steve?
Yeah, reductionism is basically the idea or the belief that everything can be explained by its constituent parts. So, for example, in a kind of a materialistic worldview or physicalist worldview, all that we are is basically what we're made of, the particles that we're made of. So we're basically then reduced to bags of chemicals on bones.
Yeah. Now, this is, that's an important worldview to understand, by the way. This took me way too long to figure out. So, listeners, like I impart this gold nugget to you. And that is that we live in a culture today of that's referred to in a couple different ways. It's referred to as materialism, mm-hmm. naturalism, physicalism. Mm-hmm. You could nuance them differently, but they all pretty much mean the same thing. Mm-hmm. And basically what they are is it's a commitment that really developed in the Enlightenment mm-hmm. that all that exists is the physical. All that exists is the material, the natural world. That's all that there really is. And beyond all that, there isn't anything else. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they would know that there is nothing more to this world than just the physical stuff that we're made of, matter and energy. But that is a very prevalent view, and so I think that also kind of leads us down some very bizarre views of humanity.
Yeah, and ultimately into this whole zombie culture problem. Because I wish we had time to tease out how this developed in the Enlightenment, but just for brevity, we just don't have time to do that mm-hmm. today in this podcast. But you need to understand that we live in a culture that has begun and is a process of continuing to divorce itself from God entirely. In doing so, and the only way to do it is to hold this stance that, like you said, there's reasons for this. This is an a priori belief. This is mm-hmm. this is taken on faith. That all that exists is the physical world. Now, this will explain for some of you why you have conversations with your atheist friends, mm-hmm. and it seems as though it is impossible to convince them that God exists.
Right.
And the reason is?
Because they just a priori assume that all there is to this world is matter and energy.
Exactly. It is impossible to convince mm-hmm. them that God exists. God's not even a possible option within their worldview.
You got to deal with that assumption first. The materialistic assumption first before you can even get started.
Exactly. So this is kind of a bizarre idea. It means then that for many people, God is a secondary belief, not a primary belief. Mm. Their primary belief is that the physical world is all that exists.
That's right.
And so the implication is, thus, God doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So now think about this. If this is your operating worldview, it means then that if you want to understand what anything is, well, then you just boil it down to its constituent parts, that at the end of the day, it is just material. It's just it's just nature. It's just physical stuff. This is what leads us into a significant problem. And ultimately, the problem is, as I've said, is dehumanization. We lose our humanity. Mm-hmm. We ultimately just become particles. Or in this case, if you're going to take a human being and you're going to reduce us to our parts, this is how a human reduces. We are an organism that's made up of organs. Organs are made up of tissues. Tissues are made up of cells. Cells are made up of proteins. And proteins are made up of amino acids. Mm-hmm. Now, they're made up of, there's around 20 to 23 different amino acids that are found in life. They need to be correctly sequenced mm-hmm. to be made into a protein. And then you have to work your way back up that chain again, and then proteins into cells, cells, tissues, tissues, organs, organs into an organism that we refer to as a person. So, under a reductionist worldview, then, what's a person? Well, we're just correctly sequenced amino acids, mm-hmm. ultimately. And like Steve, like you said, we're just bags of chemicals. Yeah. Well, then, the question is, well, what in us is correctly sequencing these amino acids to make a person? And the answer to that is DNA. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that DNA obviously does more than that, but those are Nobel prizes in the making. Thus far, what we know of DNA is that it correctly sequences amino acids into proteins. How it's able to do the rest of the chain that I talked about, mm-hmm. proteins into cells and further on.
Making those jumps.
Yeah. We just have no idea. Mm-hmm. If anything, that just goes to show how incredibly complicated DNA is. In fact, DNA is a code of four. It's not binary like a computer. Mm-hmm. What would that be?
Quadrenary? I don't know.
And ultimately, there's 3.5-ish billion letters long. Wow. that make up a human strand of DNA, which, I mean, is truly incredible. When you consider that the diameter of DNA, a DNA molecule, is only 2 nanometers. Now consider this, a human hair is the diameter of a human hair is 100,000 nanometers. So DNA is only 2 nanometers across. This blows my mind. It's been calculated that a single teaspoon of DNA could hold, so if you had a single teaspoon and you filled it full of DNA, it could hold 1 strand of DNA from every species that has ever existed and still have room for the information of every book that's ever been written. I know, right? It's just mind-boggling. For those of you that are in college, you'll appreciate this. If DNA were an essay, it'd be approximately 5 million pages long, single-space, 12-point font.
And you know how much time you have to put into an essay to write even a 10-page paper. So these are a lot of hours.
And so here's, I think, the problem, though. Because those numbers are so huge and DNA is so mind-boggling, I think people can put in these bizarre assertions, and all of a sudden you'll be willing to believe it. When people start to go, oh, and by P.S., by the way, that's all you are, is just DNA. And somehow, all that information, when it comes together, will create consciousness. Hmm. Now, this has ultimately created countless movies that the internet's going to take over the world.
Right.
Or if you have a supercomputer, it's going to, you know, take on consciousness. And by the way, it always turns evil.
I don't know why that happens.
We've yet to see a wonderfully loving computer yet that takes on consciousness.
Possibly with the exception of Big Hero.
Oh, yeah. Big Hero, though, is interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because they played with ideas of personhood, but at the end of the day, it was
the card.
Yeah, it was just this card, yeah. Right? Ultimately, you have algorithms again. Mm-hmm. But so the idea is, and this is why our culture plays on this idea, that if you have enough information, well, it should create consciousness, shouldn't it? And for many people, they were actually quite scared about the internet because you have so much information. Would this information take on consciousness? Lo and behold, we have supercomputers. We have the internet has not taken on consciousness. This actually has raised some significant questions in our culture of what does it mean actually to be a person then? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's interesting, and this has created problems. Now, you're gonna notice that this is a theme with all these talks on zombie culture, is we're talking about that a person ultimately, or one of the other things that we're talking about, in this case a person, that there are things about us that cannot be explained in a physicalist, naturalistic, materialist worldview. Now, you might be like, well, what do you mean? And I hope that you're understanding why this is important. It means that if I can demonstrate that I'm more than the physical, it means that there must be something non-physical that is a part of my makeup, and that this must be inherently necessary for what it means to be a person. Did that make sense, Steve?
It made sense to me, but then I've been around you a while, so I don't know if that made sense to our listeners. If not, send Andy an email.
I hope that this makes sense. We need to demonstrate that a person's more than the physical, and so I want to share some of that evidence with you. First off, it's important to know that although I'm coded for life, my life's not coded for. There seems to me that I have inherently a will, a free will, mm-hmm. in which I am able to choose what I do. Now, under a materialistic worldview, that's not right. The case. They would hold to determinism, that I basically have been scripted by not only the Big Bang itself and the trajectory of my particles, but in DNA, mm-hmm. that I basically am in my I am my DNA, and as Dawkins says, we just dance to our DNA. So I'm just living out my DNA. There really is no Andy at play here. There is no will. Whatever I do, whether it be the moving of my arm or whatever that might be, mm-hmm. it was coded for.
And this is something we've mentioned before too, but if we really are just particles in motion, then it'd be really hard to determine what Andy Steiger exactly is, because every time you lose a cell or gain a cell, you would be a different person too. that's, or different group of cells.
That's correct. In fact, the Greeks told a story about this. What is it?
I think it was Aristotle, wasn't it, about the ship?
Yeah. What was that ship's name, though? Is it I can't remember the ship's name. And the idea was just simply this. If you replace one plank of this ship, and I think that their idea was every year, mm-hmm. but you kept the plank that you took away, mm-hmm. after long enough, you would have two ships there. Mm-hmm. And the question is just, well, which one was the original ship that you started with? The idea, though, that we're playing off is that every 7 years, mm-hmm. all of our cells are replaced in our body.
Right.
But yet, there seems to be this enduring self that Steve, you know, you don't change every 7 years.
No.
That you remain the same person, even though the physical stuff that makes you up has changed. But let me just take a moment to go back and talk about what I was just saying there, that my life's not coded for. So think about this for a second. Wherever you are right now, move your finger. Okay, so Steve just moved his finger. I just moved my finger. What made your finger move? This is an important question to ask. Now you could say, well, my son would say, well, Dad, my muscles in my finger made my finger move. And it's like, absolutely right. Your muscles in your finger contracted and made your finger move. But what made your muscles contract? You know, and somebody could come along and say, well, if you stimulate muscle with an electric current, that'll make mm-hmm. muscles contract. He's like, okay, that's right. Now, what made that electric current do that? Well, you could say, to speed this along, that there were the synapses in my brain were firing that sent an electric pulse mm-hmm. That went to my finger that made my muscles contract and made my finger move. Then the question becomes, well, what made your synapse fire? Now, in neurology right now, we know that before you act, before I move my finger, mm-hmm. that we have these preemptive things actually that will take place inside of our brain mm-hmm. that come before the actual act. And so some people will say, well, maybe that's what's causing your finger to move. And the question is, no. What caused that? What was the initial cause that began that whole chain of reactions to start? Mm-hmm. What's the primary cause?
Right. And it goes into almost right to the Big Bang then, doesn't it? Like, because if we're living in a physicalist world,
right,
then you go back, you kind of trace all of these natural causes, right?
You would have to. That's your only option, is to trace all the natural causes, whether that be to your DNA, to the Big Bang itself. They would all need to be causally related.
Right, which is what you meant by, if you remember from the last podcast episode, you mentioned the trajectory. Basically, that's all we are. So in terms of moral responsibility and all of that, we're just, all we have is this trajectory of natural causes.
Now think about that for a second. This leads into that whole dehumanization thing. Mm-hmm. Well, now what am I? Again, I just become these particles. I'm just chemicals reacting and really nothing more, which raises some significant problems mm-hmm. in our legal system, for example. Well, now if I murder somebody, am I responsible? Mm-hmm. Is it my fault that my DNA behaved that way or that the trajectory of my life was leading in that direction? You know, in what sense am I morally accountable for right. my actions? Mm-hmm. Well, we won't continue down that trajectory.
Because we'll eventually talk about it more in detail.
Exactly. So I want to get back to some other ideas that are problematic with the physicalist worldview. Mm-hmm. One of the problems is I have a friend of mine who's a doctor. And I was talking to him, and he and I were having this conversation about when he's seen patients. And I said, and this actually came up in that movie, Big Hero 6. Mm-hmm. Notice that what was it,
Baymax.
Yes, sorry, Baymax. Notice Baymax, he's basically a physician mm-hmm. of sorts, kind of like a superhero physician. And the kid, who I can't remember his name either.
Hero.
Hero. Hero gets hurt, if you remember. And Baymax begins to scan Hero. Mm-hmm. And what does he do to find out if Baymax is hurt or how much pain Baymax is in. Sorry, Baymax is asking Hero how much pain Hero's in. And he gives him a chart, if you remember.
Right.
The chart appears on his stomach, and then Hero needs to tell him where he fits on the chart. Now, what's interesting about that is I thought that was fascinating, by the way, because doctors have to do the same thing. If they want to know how much pain you're in, they've got to show you a chart, and you need to tell them where you are on the chart. Notice that Baymax could not scan Hero and find out that information.
Right, because if everything is just kind of objective physical reality, then why couldn't we just scan the electric impulses and things like that and actually figure out how much pain this person is actually in? Right, but we can't do that now, can we? We actually have to take into account some kind of a subjective experience. But if we're all particles, then where is this subjective experience coming in?
Yeah, and exactly. And more than that, my friend, this physician would say to me, Andy, we have no access to what it's like to be you. Mm-hmm. We have no ability to know what you're feeling. All I can do is ask you, and you can tell me, but I can't access that. Now, that raises some serious problems. Mm-hmm. Well, why can't you access that? Mm-hmm. Why can't you access the first-person perspective of what it's like to be me? Now, this raises even more questions. Well, what does that even mean to say, to be me? I mean, how is it that a bunch of amino acids correctly sequenced could have thoughts about amino acids? Like, how is it that amino acids are thinking about amino acids? Mm-hmm. It would seem as though that there is something else at play here. A famous thought experiment is called the Mary problem. And this is a well-known thought experiment in philosophy of mind. And the Mary problem goes like this. What if you had a scientist named Mary, and Mary lived in her office? So she never left her office. She just lived in this office, and her office was black and white. And everything that Mary had access to was black and white. And as a scientist, her field of study was vision. So all she studied was the chemical reactions that took place for vision. She understood vision perfectly. She had all the information. She had all the physical information about vision. And at the end of the day, then we could ask this a simple question. If she has all the physical information about vision, does she have all the information, or is she lacking any information about vision? And we would ultimately say, well, it seems as though she would still be lacking information about vision. And we could say, well, what would she be lacking? Obviously, she'd be lacking the experience of color.
Right.
But that raises a problem. How could she be lacking anything if she knows everything physical that there is to know about it?
Right. Especially if the worldview is a physicalist worldview and that's all you have. So if that's the case, then by studying the physical stuff, you should be able to figure out everything. There shouldn't be anything lacking because there isn't anything more to the physical reality.
Such as, I should be able to get your DNA sequence, Steve, and I should be able to sit down with your million-page essay, right? You know, 5 million-page essay, and I should be able to read that essay, and at the end of something like 37 years of reading that bad boy, I should know you perfectly. I should know everything that there is to know about Steve by reading his DNA. However, we know that that's not the case. That just because you know all the facts about Steve, his DNA specifically, doesn't mean that you have all the information or all the knowledge that there is to know about Steve. We would say that you're still lacking something. What are you lacking? Well, you're lacking the experience of Steve, first of all. Mm-hmm. To actually meet Steve and to talk to Steve. There's this knowledge that seems to be non-physical that is inherent in people. One of the other things that I find fascinating about this is that when kids come into the world, we never need to explain to them that they're a person. It's not like, you know, they as they grow up, we need to let them know, hey, by the way, you're a person. We come into the world inherently understanding what we are. We don't question what we are, and we inherently are able to interact with one another. on a relational level. It seems to me that we are created with an intuitive understanding.
You know, there was something fascinating that happened in my household just a couple of weeks ago. I was playing with my daughter, Maya. She's about 19 months old now, coming up to 19 months. And she was playing with those washable markers, right? She likes to color and whatnot. And she was taking the cap off, putting it back on, and things like that. And every time she pulled the cap off, we'd be just kind of clapping and saying, "Hey, you did it, you did it." And then at some point, she actually said this. She says, "I did it." And I thought that was really fascinating. How is it that all, because we never said, "I did it," we said, "You did it," but she somehow seemed to understand that she said, "I did it." And she's been saying that since, "I did it," even though we keep saying, "You did it."
Hmm.
Just trying to get her to say that, but no, she'll just say, "I did it, I did it." And at some point, I started thinking, how did she know? How did she come to that concept of this, what Martin Buber calls I-thou relationship, that separation? How did she know that she was her own self? I thought that was really fascinating. We didn't teach her that. She just knew it.
It's one of the things that I love about being a parent is I feel like I'm constantly in this experiment of watching them develop. And I'm constantly doing different things to see how they're processing the world and understanding things.
Seriously, parents are the biggest evil scientists in the world.
Well, I try not to be too evil, but definitely but definitely am doing different experiments with my kids on how they think about the world. And it is, it's truly fascinating. Mm-hmm. Because I think too often we take these things for granted. And it too often we're watching movies and we are taking for granted this idea that your cell phone could be a person. Mm-hmm. That you could have some sort of romantic relationship with your cell phone, like that movie Her, or romantic relationship mm-hmm. with a code, with this,
right.
Whether or not an evil villain could be created into an algorithm and living that out. You know, what we really need to engage with what's being thrown our way, and thinking not only, okay, is that possible? But if it were possible, what are the implications of that? See, it's significant to note that we were made in the image of God. We were made in a relational image. It shouldn't surprise us that we desire relationship. More than that, though, it's significant to note that we have an author. We were created. We're not our own. We did not create or make ourselves. And that we owe our existence to something greater than ourselves. And that we are then responsible the way not only that we treat ourselves, but also the way that we treat other people. People do not belong to me. They are not just bags of chemicals. They are inherently valuable and important because they were made in God's image and they belong to God. And for that reason alone, I need to care and protect for human life. But in our culture, if we continue to go down this idea of anthropomorphizing things instead of theopomorphizing mm-hmm. and understanding ourselves theopomorphically, then more and more we're going to head down this path of seeing people or persons as just correctly sequenced code, mm-hmm. whether that be digital code or that be organic code. I mean, in fact, it was kind of funny. I was watching a TV show recently, and this person, a biological person, met another. Well, he sees another person, and he starts talking to this person, and starts to realize that there's something not quite right. And as they're talking, he ultimately goes to catch that person or to grab them and finds out it's just a hologram. So this whole time he's been talking with a hologram, and he goes, "Oh, you're not a person. Mm-hmm. You're just a computer." And this hologram goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." He goes, "Well, what do you mean by a person?" And this hologram begins this dialogue with this person saying, well, you're just, you know, biological code. I'm mm-hmm. digital code. Mm-hmm. You know, you are carbon, I'm silicon." You know, it goes back and forth with these different ideas. Well, I'm made this way, you're made in that way. So in what sense do you say that you're a person? Yeah. And so ultimately, as Christians, we're saying, well, what sense are you a person? Well, you're a person because you were made by God and you were made in God's image. And that this idea of personhood then, don't want to get too much into this, is both a person then is both physical and non-physical. That there is a physical component to us, our biological makeup that makes us who we are, but there is this non-physical component, what we would refer to as a soul. And that personhood aspect of us can not only live beyond the physical, but that this person that makes us up is the primary cause that we were talking about earlier with why my finger moves. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the ways that you could look at this is like the soul as the driver of a car and the body being the car. Now, the two are interconnected. You can't separate the two from one another. They're both necessary. But the car is not the driver, and the driver is not the car. Mm-hmm. But that the two work together.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I find that illustration really helpful. It helps me kind of put things into perspective when we're thinking about the body and the soul. Because we're so saturated in the materialistic worldview, physicalist worldview, we tend to think, well, we are our brain, right? So when the brain shuts down, we ourselves shut down. But if you think of it in terms of the car and the driver, well, if the car breaks down, well, the driver's still there. The driver just can't get anywhere without that car.
Yeah, some people ask, well, like, what about people that have a handicapped or something like that? You know, are they any less of a person? Well, we'd say, well, of course not. They're a complete person, but it would be like a car that has a flat tire. Does that mean that the car doesn't have a driver? Well, no, the car still has a driver, but the driver is limited by the physical issues that it's at play, whether that be a flat tire, or that be a missing fender. I mean, because in the same way, right, we wouldn't say that if, Steve, if you lost your arm, God forbid, by like some sort of ninja accident or something.
Right. It had to be a ninja accident.
we wouldn't say that you're less of a person. If you, in the same way, even if you lost part of your brain, I mean, people have had scoops of their brain taken out, from cancer or whatever else. Interestingly enough, memories are not held in any specific spot. It's not like all of a sudden you would forget, B of the alphabet and that'd be permanently lost. I mean, those things aren't found in one specific spot. But but my point being, we wouldn't consider you less of a person because you were missing a part of you. We would still say, no, you're still 100% a person. If you've ever seen the movie RoboCop.
That's right.
I mean, there's hardly anything left of him. And in fact, if you watch the most recent version, it's so disturbing to him. He says, "Don't ever show me that again." Like, there's just hardly anything left. But still, we would say, no, he's 100% a person, even though there's hardly anything physically left of him. By the way, I know we're running out of time here, but this just needs to be said. That means then that there's a distinction between an animal and a person. So we would say, and Christians have historically held to, that animals have souls. So that's an animal is still going to require a soul. It's still going to require some sort of primary mover. Like we don't see animals as, although they have instinct, we don't see them as deterministic. I have no idea what a deer is going to do. I have no idea what my dog's going to do. I have ideas of what it would or wouldn't do, but whether it's going to turn right or left or whatever it's going to do, I mean, it is a type of person. It's a type of a soul, if you will, that is interacting with the physical.
You would just say that it's just not a human soul.
Right, and I'd make a distinction. I don't even know if I'd use the word person in that sense, because I wouldn't want to confuse those two.
Right.
Because we're going to say then, well, what's the difference between a person or a human? What's the difference between a human and an animal? And we're going to say the difference is that we were made in God's image. And it seems that inherent to that are many, many different things, but one of the things that's inherent in that is that we are relational, that we are able to be in relationship not only with ourselves, but to the other things. And that seems to me to be one of one of the things that it means to be made in the image of God. And we don't see that in animals, this mm-hmm. ability to be in relationship to themselves mm-hmm. Or to one another in any sort of meaningful way of what a human would have. Or another one being the ability to endow things with meaning,
right.
purpose, or significance. Mm-hmm. We have yet to come across an animal that has language. Mm-hmm. Sure, we have animals that can make noises or whatnot, and they will
communicate
that way. But scientists debate heavily over that if that's actually a language.
Right.
It's kind of like Pavlov's dog. You can ring a bell and you can get a dog to salivate, mm-hmm. but whether or not that's a language, or you communicate, like there's mm-hmm. a cause and effect. But that's different than how humans are able to endow things with meaning, and that we have language, and that we're able to communicate like we're communicating now. That we're able to endow something non-physical onto mm-hmm. the physical and use it as a mode of being in relationship with one another. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that made sense.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to end with this then. I thought I'd end with, so we've already run out of time, but I mean there's so many other things we could have talked about.
Right.
Let me just close with Peter Singer, of all people.
Oh, yes.
Can you want to tell people just a little bit about?
Peter Singer is probably one of the most renowned ethicists of our day. I'm not sure where he was trained. Was it Princeton?
Or, I'm not sure either.
Maybe he teaches at Princeton. I'm not sure. But he is probably the most well-known ethicist of our day, and he is a very straightforward physicalist, as I understand it. And he's known for saying that a child with disability is less valuable than a pig, which I would say is consistent with a materialist worldview.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Dawkins just not recent now, but this is a couple months ago, mm-hmm. earlier this year, tweeted out to one of the people that followed him that they were pregnant with a Down syndrome child.
Right.
And that she was in an ethical dilemma, to which Dawkins tweeted back, abort it and try again. It would be
right.
immoral to bring it into the world
right.
if you have the choice.
That's very revealing.
Yeah, and so that's kind of that idea, and these are similar ideas that Peter Singer has been promoting. This is what he wrote. He said this, "Whatever the future holds, it is likely to prove impossible to restore the full sanctity of life view. The philosophical foundations of this view have been knocked asunder. We can no longer base our ethics on the idea that human beings are a special form of creation made in the image of God, singled out from all other animals and alone possessing an immortal soul. Or, better, understanding of our own nature as bridged the gulf that has once thought to lie between ourselves and other species. So why should we believe that the mere fact that a being is a member of the species Homo sapien endows its life with some unique, almost infinite value?" And I think that ultimately this is the question that we're going to be continually confronted with.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that be from speciesism, am I more important than a squirrel? Mm-hmm. To what of human life has any value whatsoever? And what does it even mean then to be a human? How will my life be any more or less valuable than the code that makes up my computer? These are questions that our culture will continue to face, and it's one of the reasons why I think this topic of zombie culture is so significant and important to talk about, and that the church has got to get straight. The idea of what it means to be a person is incredibly important.
Very good. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us today. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been the ministry of Apologetics Canada. We'll see you next time.
I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.